to a young girl. And it is the most, it's much more sexy than Freud. But in through the whole thing, he has this complete faith in the unconscious and its wisdom. And a friend to whom I once lent this book years ago said, after reading that, I will never be afraid of getting sick again. Because he pointed out about all sickness, that sickness is really not a disease, but a symptom of the unconscious, trying to cure you. And therefore, just as one does not simply knock down a fever with quinine, because that would stop the work of the fever, so perhaps one should not knock down all sorts of diseases, because for purposes which we do not as yet understand, the unconscious is using them for a constructive purpose. But now, so you see, this was something Freud was fumbling after. The notion of an intelligence in us greater than the intelligence of consciousness, and operating in an unconscious way. Note the choice of words. Why didn't he say superconscious? Because the climate of opinion at the time in which he was alive wanted to insist that everything below human conscious reason was stupid. That mere matter, blind energy, had displaced God upon the throne of heaven. But it comes back, you see, with Freud, that you cannot eliminate the unconscious as part of your essential operation, yourself. You cannot say, because you are an inseparable part of the world, you cannot divvy up responsibility and say, you should praise me for that, I should blame you for that. It's your fault. No, it wasn't. It's your fault. You know? All this is a perfectly silly argument. And if we think it dignifies human beings and gives them a sense of, theologians are always talking a lot of nonsense about this kind of thing. They're saying that the dignity of man depends upon each individual assuming his responsibility. And then as soon as they start doing this, they're going, yeah, 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 tis, tisn't, you know, and arranging who's to be clobbered, who's the fall guy, who gets the blame for this situation. It's usually somebody who was just happened to be standing by when it happened. So, if then you understand that you are an integral functioning part of this whole cosmos, what price do you pay for stopping this yak, yak, yak about it's your fault, my fault, etc.? The price you pay is you have to admit your own complicity in the catastrophes that occurred to you. You have to see that everything that comes to you is what went out of you. Everything that comes to you is a return to you of what went out of you. You asked for it. But it's not the conscious you that asked for it. Not the you that is just the spotlight consciousness. Because that's unconscious of most of the things that go on in you. So you get a curious, fascinating picture of how things are operating underneath the surface. This is what's so valuable about studying some science. take a very so-called simple science, like elementary botany, or best of all, a kind of elementary course in ecology, plant, microbe, organism relationships. And what you see is this. You see a developing pattern in which everything that happens gets integrated into the whole thing that's going on. That what is, from one point of view, say the disease of a certain plant, is the method of reproduction of some other species. If we get, say, malaria from Anopheles mosquitoes, that's because Anopheles mosquitoes have an extraordinary reproduction cycle that involves their being parasitic to us. Now, if you take the Anopheles point of view, it becomes man. You see? So that as you study these systems, you see what is going on is, so we need a little bit this way. And somebody says, oh no, that's going too far. And then they say, they pull it and it comes back. You see, now a little bit this way. You get it going over here. And then they say, oh, that's a, no, that's too much, too much, too much. They feel a strain or something and they say, too much. So there's this constant adjustment going on. And if you would examine, for example, the sharp edge of a leaf, you put it under a huge microscope and there's a churning going along. And there are certain little elements, cells in that leaf, you see, that want to go way out there. And if they do, you know, the leaf is disintegrating into gas. And but then some police come along that line and say, hey, get back inside, keep in. They're saying, no, you're destroying our liberty. We want to go out. See, go, get in. And this whole thing, this clamor goes along the edge of the leaf, see? From our point of view, it's a perfectly stable, clean edge. We're not looking closely enough. So our turmoils, our problems, our wars and calamities and atomic explosions mean if the planet blows up, that's going to be like Selig Morgenrath once showed me a great plant covered in green fly. They were succulent and fat and having a ball. Came by the next day, all thing was gray dust. They'd eaten up the plant and disintegrated. As a fact of nature around here, we say, thank heavens for that. Those green flies just ate the weed up. And both of them were pests anyway. It works out in the balancing system of nature. So we are doubtless in the same situation. And only we have a kind of blinkers on, whereby we only see half the picture. We get the end of it, that it can push us around. But we don't get the end of it, that being pushed around is what we asked for. We evoked it all by the very fact that we're here. Children don't think that they are responsible for being born. They blame their parents, not realizing that they can't really separate themselves from their parents. That in the measure that, for example, I have sexual desires, I can really understand my father's predicament. And I couldn't possibly blame him because actually I was the evil gleam in his eye when he approached my mother. You know, I asked for it. Now, you can see in this that your relationship to the world as being responsible for everything that happens to you is not the same as an ordinary boss who would be a magician and say that all sorts of improbable things should happen. Rather, it is this. You will think, if you think of yourself only as the consciousness, then if you get some ideas from me about being in control of everything that happens to you, you will act stupidly as if you were the boss of the whole thing, like a kind of a lunatic thinking he's God. But if, on the other hand, you understand that your real self is the wisdom that is expressed in the intelligent form of your organism, then you won't fall into the error of thinking your relationship to the world of being that as its governor.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share your comments and feedback with others. Better Listen presents Space and Reincarnation with Alan Watts.
This morning I want to talk about space in relation to what is ordinarily called reincarnation. Because this is one of the most fascinating applications of the sense that space constitutes something significant. Now, the subject of reincarnation is one around which is ringed an incredible amount of hocus-pocus. And yet, there is something in it. And there seems to be something in it, not mainly because there is a lot of alleged evidence for it in the form of stories of children who remember their former lives and so on. I want to approach the subject much in the way that Erwin Schrödinger, the physicist, does, because he has a view of this that does not involve any hocus-pocus at all. It is perfectly simple. And all the evidence for it is already before us. So it involves no claim to special inside psychic knowledge, but merely to grasping a principle that is staring us in the face. And this principle is difficult to understand, not because there's any inherent intellectual complexity to it, but simply because it requires getting across something that's just unfamiliar. There is obviously some sort of analogy, which I've already drawn your attention to, between space and unconsciousness. Between stars, there is darkness. Between stars, there is not the energy which constitutes a so-called body. In some modern physical theory that is purely hypothetical, not really tested, bodies in space are thought of as points at which space is intensified. But at any rate, there are these gaps, these intervals. And obviously the unconscious state must appear always to the conscious state as a gap or interval. So when we go to sleep at night, we wake up in the morning almost instantly. In other words, there appears to have happened nothing except something quite vague between going to sleep and waking, unless you had dreams. And so you can conceive, or barely conceive, going to sleep but not waking up. Or the reverse of it, waking up without ever having gone to sleep. Which appears to be the nearest we can imagine to death and birth, respectively. To go to sleep and never wake up when we die. When we were born, to wake up, but not to remember ever having gone to sleep. And of course, this bugs our imagination, because it's inconceivable in terms of consciousness. People are afraid, some people are afraid, of the possibility of eternal annihilation. And I suppose one of the most eloquent expressions of that is John Betjeman's poem, Before the Anesthetic, where he would prefer rather even the dismal hells than that this eye should cease to be. And other people, perhaps of a more rational bent, say, well, that's no problem. Because if you simply cease to be, there's nobody to be disturbed by it. You can't experience not being there forever. And what most people do is they project upon the prospect of annihilation the imagination of being shut up in a dark prison, in, as it were, a super sensory deprivation chamber, forever. But of course, there is no, the notion of eternal annihilation really has no meaning. It is an attempt to conceive nothingness, non-experience, and so far as our imaginations are concerned, nature abhors a vacuum. We have to project something into that. Because psychologically as well as logically, it is a void. However, you see, just as we've been discussing the notion that all creatures whatsoever, not to mention all people, feel themselves in the middle. They feel central to their experience. And being central to experience is the nearest thing I can conceive as a meaning for the word I. Not an ego, because that is a social structure, a social institution, which has been kind of implanted upon our psychological behavior, upon, shall we say, experience, because experience is a thing that we are taught. We are taught what experiences are permissible and what are not, just in the same way as we are taught what speech is permissible and what is not, and what gestures are permissible, what actions are permissible and what are not. So our experience is trained, and we are trained to experience ourselves as egos. But still, underneath the implantation of the ego experience, there is this sensation of centrality. You may feel that your center is isolated, as in the ego thing, or you may feel that your center is simply the center of a being, which is you, which extends to the ultimate limits. But in every case, there is this sense of centrality in every being that exists. And therefore, every being is I, just as you are. And there are always I's in this sense. So long as the planet endures and there are living creatures on it, this is a planet which I's. And so long as there is the possibility that anywhere in the galaxies there should be such a planet or creatures who have who focus the centrality feeling of the universe, there is I. And that I is always you. We know that when people die, other people are born after them. And that is all the evidence we need for the notion of